Karima Benoun, welcome to the studio. It's really nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be in Prague.
You wrote the book, which was published recently in Czech Republic, Your Fatwa Doesn't Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. You interviewed nearly 300 people from different countries, from Afghanistan to Mali. Did all the story really begin in your flat in 1993? What happened?
So the story begins with my own father, who was from Algeria and was like many other Algerian intellectuals who spoke out against the rise of the fundamentalist armed groups back in the 90s, groups that were a lot like Islamic State, so-called, is today. And my father received threats and at one point even people showing up at the apartment. And that's where the book started for me. One day when someone came to the house, we didn't know who they were. It was exactly the same time of day as a friend of my father's had been killed the week before. And that for me was the starting moment of the book. So what I tried to do was to go find as many people like my father around the world today and bring them the attention that they deserve.
And you really thought that with a little knife you can defend yourself and your dad?
Well, we didn't know who was outside the door, and we never did find out that day, but we knew that the armed Islamic group had killed my father's colleague 1 week before, and I couldn't think of anything else to do, so I got the knife out of the kitchen drawer, and I stood there, and it was kind of ridiculous, and I just couldn't think of anything better to do. So the book is about my trying to find something better to do to help people, which is by trying to get them more international support.
Can you describe 90s in Algeria? Because I understood there were thousands of people being murdered by fundamentalists, but, you know, the international society, United Nations, no one seemed to care. Why was that?
So the Algerians call the 1990s the dark decade, and it was a decade when fundamentalist armed groups that were trying to take power in society, in waging their war against the state, basically declared war against the civilian population and killed thousands and thousands of people. The state also committed some serious abuses in its fight against terrorism, so it was a very difficult time. But women's rights activists spoke out. When there would be a terrorist bombing, they would go the next day to the bomb crater and protest and fill it with flowers. And intellectuals spoke out. When the headquarters of Algerian journalism was blown up in 1996, the journalists remained in the ruins of their offices to publish the papers the next day. So people resisted.
How old were you at that time?
I was in my 20s and I was studying outside of Algeria, and I went back and forth as often as I could until 1996, when my father said, please don't come back.
Mm-hmm. Your dad wanted to write a book, Why I Split from the Faith. So was it more a joke, or he really seriously thought about it?
In fact, the title was Why I Became an Apostate. And an apostate is what the fundamentalists label somebody who they believe to have left Islam. Often people who, in fact, have not made that choice. Sometimes people who have made that choice, which is a free human right. But my father was trying to explain why he had received this label from the fundamentalists, and that was for exercising his right to freedom of conscience and freedom of thought, which is something that he was determined to defend. And I was very frightened for him, so I said, please don't write this book. But he just believed that if people didn't speak out, things would get worse. And he was very proud of the Muslim tradition in which he grew up. And he said, the jihadists have trampled Islam underfoot in the name of jihad. They represent a radical break with the Islam as it was lived by our ancestors.
Can you make us understand what was so wrong in the time of your father to teach Darwinism?
Well,
you know, it's usual for us here.
Unfortunately, it's a global struggle to teach Darwin and evolution. In fact, there are now, according to the New York Times, some big areas in the heartland of the United States where the teachers sometimes don't teach evolution in the high school because they will get so much pressure from the Christian fundamentalist parents and groups if they do that. So my father was a part of this global struggle of free thinkers in his context to teach evolution back in the late 80s and early 90s in Algeria. And some of the fundamentalist students came to him and said, we refuse to study this. And he said, well, on your exam, can you please write what the theory is? And then at the bottom, you can write, I do not believe in this theory. And they said, no, absolutely, they refused, but they would think about it. And they came back the next day, and in fact, they had a pamphlet from the Christian right in the United States against evolution that had been translated into Arabic. And they said, look, Professor Bannoun, even the Americans are rejecting evolution, so we refuse to study this. But I think it's really a serious point about acceptance of science, which is something that the fundamentalists in Muslim contexts often are rejecting. They accept technology, which is very useful for them, but the science, which is the sort of important thinking behind it, is much more controversial. So at its heart, really, I would say, the battle against fundamentalism is many things, but it's also an intellectual battle for freedom of thought.
As you spoke about the dark decade in Algeria, can you describe the fundamentalism in, let's say, 90s and the recent one? Is there any difference?
Well, I would say many Algerians now will say, if the world had paid attention to what we suffered back then, which was the pre-9/11 world, so it wasn't taken very seriously, if the world had paid attention to what we suffered back then, they might have understood the danger so as to avoid some of the worst events that we have seen recently. Many of the practices of Daesh, of the so-called Islamic State, were also practiced by the armed Islamic group in its war against Algerian society, such as the kidnapping of girls and the practice of sexual slavery, for example, and the attempt to justify that in the name of their interpretation of religion, which I must stress is only their interpretation and one that is rejected by the mainstream of society. So the context is different today, and certainly the use of the internet and that sort of cyber dimension to the recruitment and so on is quite different. But I think there is a great deal that we can learn from and should learn from that time period to help us find the best answers now.
Why there is such a big number of people talking about the clash of civilization? I'm sure you have to, you know, answer this question hundreds of times. So
this paradigm of the so-called clash of civilizations is very popular in certain quarters, I would say, both in the West and even indeed among the Muslim fundamentalists. The idea that in the world there are separate civilizational camps which can only relate to each other through hostility and opposition. This is not the way I see the world. I, in fact, think that there are clashes within every civilization in the world between those who are advocating more tolerant and more human views and those who are advocating more regressive views. So for me, what I'm talking about is a part of a bigger global struggle. And what we have to do is to come together, the people who are advocating equality and human rights across all of these contexts, and to stand for these principles in universal terms.
You started to work on that book in 2010, then it was 2011. How did the Arab uprisings affect your work?
Well, this is a funny story, in fact. My editor wrote to me and said at first, oh my goodness, maybe your book has become obsolete. Because, of course, when the revolutions first happened in Egypt and Tunisia and so on, the so-called Islamists were not leading them. It was really a sort of a secular wave that passed across North Africa first and then spread. But I think what we saw is that you actually couldn't arrive at democracy without both challenging autocracy and fundamentalism. You actually had to take on both of those things. You couldn't just take on one or the other in these contexts right now. So I see those as important first steps in a struggle towards more human rights, but unfortunately there's a long way to go, which includes really building a viable alternative. That, I think, is the outstanding struggle. So the alternative to fundamentalism, in my view, is not simply continuing repression or continuing lack of democracy. The alternative is really about building a better model that is more inclusive and freer.
Do you think you can tell our listeners the a difference between Islam and Islamism?
So as I say in the book, it seems like the difference is only three letters in English. But in fact, the difference is very significant. So Islam is one of the world's great religious traditions. It is followed by as many as 1.5 billion people in the world. But I would say those 1.5 billion people practice in very different ways. Some of them may be of Muslim heritage, but they don't practice. Muslims are also incredibly diverse. That is Islam, that is Muslims. And Islamism, for me, this represents certain far right-wing political movements that are seeking to use their version of Islam, which I must stress is their version, as a political project, as a tool to take power, to control other people, not as a spiritual project. And this, to me, is a very critical distinction. So my book is against Islamism, but it is absolutely not against Islam. In fact, it is the stories of Muslims and people of Muslim heritage themselves, sometimes using a religious language, sometimes using a secular language, who are challenging the Islamists and the extremists.
After interviewing so many people, after working as a human rights lawyer, that means that you have to listen to people's stories, and no matter how difficult they are. How come that all this didn't move you from your religion? I understood you're a Muslim, so...
You know, I always say that I think religion, personal beliefs are largely that. They're indeed very, very personal. And, you know, what I would say is I think I had the experience that many Iranians did originally, that the experience of fundamentalism really pushed me away from the heritage of my family on my father's side. But the experience of meeting so many people who were engaging in such a positive way, people of Muslim heritage, whether they were people who, in the middle of an interview about how they were taking on and denouncing the practice of stoning, in the middle of the interview would excuse themselves to go pray, or perhaps other people who were celebrating the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad by toasting with a glass of wine. Meeting this great diversity of people made me again very, very proud of my heritage. And I think that really needs to be understood. But I really believe, you know, that faith is a matter of human choice. People have a right to believe or not to believe. It is a guaranteed human right in international law, and they have a right to believe in different ways.
How did you solve the question of publishing the names or identities of the people you talked to, knowing that it could mean a death sentence for them?
I always asked people if I could use their name or not, and sometimes even if they said yes, I chose not to. But I had an experience I'll never forget with a woman named Sharifa Kedar, who lost her brother and her sister to the armed Islamic group back in the 1990s. And her mother, in fact, had just come home from Hajj, had just made the pilgrimage to Mecca about 40 days before her children were killed. And I said to Sharifa, who works with an association of victims, can I really use people's names? I'm very nervous about this. And she said, look, if someone said not to use their name, don't use it. But if someone said you could use their name, I'm begging you to use it, because we want people to know that we're real, that we exist. And I truly believe that the more people who speak out against extremists, the safer those who speak out will be.
Why is it any of those brave people is less well known as Ali al-Awlaki or Osama bin Laden?
That's a great question. And I ask myself this time and time again. When you see people like the activists I saw in Pakistan who were protesting on the street against the sentencing to death of a woman for blasphemy, and they were out there protesting even though they were told suicide bombers would come if they did. And the woman activist who organized it, she said on the phone to the person who threatened her, come with your suicide bombers if you have to, but we will be there. You see this kind of courage, and you think again, you know, why is it that this story is not being told? I think partly it's a very complicated story, and we want simple narratives in this day and age, and we have to get beyond that simplicity. I also think that to tell this story, you have to go out there, right? You have to go out and meet people. And I think we're seeing the challenge with a lot of journalism in the world, especially print journalism. There's less funding for the foreign correspondents that we used to have and so on. And, you know, that really needs to change as well. So I basically decided to do whatever I could to tell these stories. People can read the book. They can read the book in Czech now. I'm so grateful to the publisher here. People can watch the TED Talk, which has subtitles in many languages, which is called When People of Muslim Heritage Challenge Fundamentalism. And I would challenge you, please, to help share these stories, whether it's the stories in my book or other stories that you can find of people who are continuing to do this work. So we all know about the terrible atrocity in Orlando on Sunday, by which I was absolutely devastated. But we also need to know, for example, about groups like Muslims for Progressive Values in the United States that actually perform same-sex Muslim marriages and have been, in fact, supporting LGBT rights as Muslims for many years. So that also has to be a part of the story.
Why you risk no living? This is the question you ask Afghan prosecutor, the only woman prosecutor, Mariah Bashir. What was the answer?
She said basically that the only way things would get better for the other Maria Bashirs to come would be if people like her who had the possibility took those risks. She was the first I believe still remains the only woman chief prosecutor in Afghanistan. She has not only received death threats, but in fact there have been attempts on her life, one of which took the leg off of one of her bodyguards and hit near where her children had been. But she absolutely refused to give up. And she really challenged the international community, as she said, not to forget about the women of Afghanistan, now that, as she said, they want peace with the Taliban. And I think that's really the challenge to all of us, to remember these people, to find thoughtful ways to support their work.
And yourself, Karima, how about yourself? Why you risk no living? Because you do, I think.
Well, you know, my greatest fear was always for the security of the people that I was writing about, because I get on a plane and I, move on. But I was always very concerned not to do anything that would put any of them at greater risk. And also sometimes to make people tell stories that are very, very difficult to tell. And I remember one woman telling me the story about the murders of her children by the armed Islamic group in Algeria back in the 90s. And she said, you know, I don't want to tell this story, but I'm going to do it for you so that you can do your work. And, you know, I was really humbled by people putting themselves through that to share these stories. And it gave me a sense of responsibility, which is to take this message as far as I can. I mean, some of the stories were just incredible. I think about a man in Algeria who ran sports programs for youth and music classes for youth back in the 90s. And he was threatened, told to stop sports, told to stop music. And finally, he had to give up the music school when the children, the students were being threatened. And finally, he was terribly assassinated. But the amazing piece about that story is not just the tragedy, it's the hope. And the hope I found in the fact that that man left behind two sons. He was killed for his work with music and with sports. He left behind two sons, one of whom wanted to be a musician and the other of whom wanted to be an athlete. So hope prevails.
Well, but I mean, going to Mali, going to Afghanistan, it's not the safest place on earth, right? I was really wondering. I know that you're like... that you're strong in this, but anyhow, you never thought that something may happen, especially if you go to interview those who are actually opponents of fundamentalists, so they're watched sometimes carefully.
I actually wrote a will before I went to Afghanistan this time, I have to say. But again, I mean, I took great precautions. I mean, already there is a risk associated with going certain places, but I tried to be as smart about it as I could and, to especially get a great deal of advice from local people. And I was very touched at how much local people were often concerned about my safety. I mean, I remember a woman who came to see me in Pakistan and, you know, she was so haunted. She was from Karachi, and she was so haunted by what had happened to the American journalist Danny Pearl. And she said, "I want you to promise me you won't meet anyone that you don't know. You know, only people who have been introduced to you by someone else." And I have to say, people really looked after me. And now I feel a responsibility to look after their stories.
Where did you find them? It's hundreds of people. It's not easy.
I worked through networks. I have been working for many years with a group called the Network of Women Living Under Muslim Laws that brings together women's human rights defenders from many countries in the world. And they developed some work on what they called warning signs of fundamentalism. That is how we identify the things that might happen so you can see this coming. So they'd been working on this for years, and I got many contacts through that network. I also, you know, in certain places, would arrive and then work through contacts, say through journalists and so on. In Algeria, I was very lucky that I had a great deal of personal contacts. And sometimes I felt as if my father was doing this work with me, although he died from an illness in 2004. He's sadly not around now. But people remember what he did and that he spoke out. And very often, you know, that would help me, for example, to meet people, find people, have access to research materials. For example, to go and see the archives of the newspaper articles written by journalists before they were killed back in the 1990s. So I felt, even in some ways, this very difficult history became kind of a blessing because people, I think, also could understand that at least in some small way, I could comprehend what they were talking about because I had, I wouldn't compare my experience to the experience of, say, someone in Afghanistan, but I at least had a window into what that experience might be.
Confidence is a very fragile thing. So, you know, if you're coming to somebody you don't know, how difficult it is just to make him believe that you want the story for the reason.
It's very difficult. And in some cases, in one case, it took me actually about 2.5 years of trying to get a particular family to tell me their story. So this was the story of Amel Zanoun Zawani, which is maybe one of the most heartbreaking stories in the book, which is about a law student in Algeria in the 1990s who was killed because she refused to give up her studies. This amazing courage of this young woman who, when the armed Islamic group, just like Boko Haram does today, said no one should study, she just kept going to her classes. And she said to her mother shortly before she was killed, you know, Mom, if anything happens, you have to keep your head held high and you have to know that we died for knowledge. And you think about, you know, what it would mean to lose someone like that. It's really overwhelming. So I can understand why they were trying to decide if they could offer me this huge gift of sharing this story with me. And I'm so glad that they did. It's one of the stories in the TED Talk. And I think it's a story that really moves people. And I hope that people will remember Emel and remember her hope. I mean, her name actually even means hope in Arabic, and help to share these kinds of stories.
So there is, we can say, hundreds of Malala Yousafzais and the girls like Amal.
No, absolutely. I mean, Malala Yousafzai is so wonderful, and I have such admiration for her, and I always just want to remind people that she represents a much broader phenomenon. Though she is very special and incredibly courageous, there are a lot of people, including sometimes quite young people, challenging these movements. I was just hearing a story, in fact, out of Iraq about how some manuscripts, very important historical Christian manuscripts, were saved. They were smuggled out with the leadership of a particular priest in Iraq, but children helped him to do this, helped him to hide these documents. So, you know, these were children saving the cultural heritage of all humankind. So indeed, there are many Malalas out there, and we have to find ways to listen to them and to support them and to do everything we can to make sure that they have the brightest possible future.
Coming back to the people in your book, what was so special about interviewing Muhammad Ali Alalu?
It was wonderful for me because I had listened to him on the radio when I was very young. Muhammad Ali Alalu was the radio show host of my favorite radio show in Algeria at a certain point called Sans Pitié. And he would do very comical things on the radio, sometimes very serious. I mean, they had a comical edge to them, but he told me the story of how he went to interview some young guys who were starting to support the fundamentalists in the late 80s, and they were all talking about jihad and how in jihad, supposedly if you die and go to paradise, there are virgins waiting for you, which is this ridiculous construct that is used to get a lot of young people who perhaps haven't had a chance to have a full life in that way to do this. And his question to them was, well, if a woman takes part in jihad, do they have men for her, or, you know, how does this work exactly? And they got so upset at him. In fact, they attacked him and his microphone ended up flying through the air. But the amazing thing is he would tell this story and laugh. He told me about getting his first death threats and how he read them on the radio. And he really used humor as a way of fighting back. And I found this in a number of places. And we're seeing this now with comedians in a number of Muslim-majority contexts. I mean, amazing comic programs on TV in Pakistan where it's like it's supposed to be what's the Taliban news, and it's just silence. I mean, it's, you know, I think humor is actually an incredibly powerful tool against all forms of extremism. We're seeing this now, for example, some of the humor that's being used against Donald Trump and his orange hair in the United States. I think humor is very humanizing and very important.
I think political situation is different from Africa to Middle East. We're talking about fundamentalism, but still, how do you think the situation will develop?
You mean globally?
Yes.
You know, an Afghan woman I interviewed who was in such a difficult security situation that she couldn't use her name, she told me, you know, I think optimism is key to survival. And I always think of an open letter that my dad wrote back in 1996, which was a very, very hard year. Sorry, in 1995, which was also a very hard year, which was an open letter to the spokesman of one of the terrorist groups in Algeria. And he said at the end, you know, at a time when his friends were being killed around him, he said to the terrorists, you know, your movement, it's basically antithetical to Islamic and universal values and common sense. Your movement is doomed to fail. And I absolutely believe that to be true. But I think what my father understood is that that's not inevitable. In other words, we all have to do whatever we can to make sure that that happens. And the road to get there may be a long one, and there may be a great deal of suffering along the way. So in the long term, I am optimistic, and ultimately, I really think it's up to all of us to pull together.
Why are you doing this? Is it a duty? Is it something you feel like you have to do? Because this is a never-ending story. I mean, this is the task for the rest of your life, I feel.
Well, I was outside studying law in the 1990s when Emel Zanoun was in Algeria studying law, and I survived, and I was safe, and my friends, I mentioned another one, Rashida Hamadi, who was an Algerian journalist, woman journalist, who was in hiding and then went home one night to visit her family and was gunned down. She died. I was safe, and I feel a huge responsibility to use that safety and the possibilities that came from my education in the United States to tell these stories, to keep this message alive, and to support the people today who are waging the same peaceful struggle, armed only with their voices and with their pens, against fundamentalism, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Nigeria or Somalia. I feel a responsibility now to stand with them. And that's the best way I can think of to keep the spirit of Rashida and Emel alive.
And it's still a personal thing, because I've seen you on TEDx and you were shaking like, you know, like the audience was. It's still very, very personal to you.
Two of the women in my book have been assassinated since the book was published. The first one was an absolutely amazing woman lawyer named Selwa Bougegas from Libya. And she fought against Gaddafi for years and years. And then when the Islamists tried to take advantage of the overthrow of Gaddafi, she stood up to them. And her security situation became so bad that she fled Libya. But she was so committed to Libya that she went back. And then she was very tragically killed on June 25th of 2014. And then last year, a woman who I met, an amazing, amazing woman named Sabine Mahmoud, who ran the T2F Cultural Cafe in Karachi. And at that cafe, I went to something called Karachi Open Mic Night, where people could come and they could sing. They would sing the poetry of Faiz Ahmed Faiz, the national poet of Pakistan, and then they would sing Leonard Cohen's Alleluia. And as I've said, you've never heard Leonard Cohen till you've heard him at Karachi Open Mic Night. And in this cafe, they would also have political discussions, including of issues like the blasphemy law. And very tragically, after one of these discussions, in April of 2015, Sabine Mahmoud was gunned down. But I always think of the poem of Faiz Ahmed Faiz that I heard sung in her cafe, which is that tyrants cannot snuff out the moon. And I think about those women, and yes, it is very personal, but most importantly, it's about them and what they stood for, and the fact that we don't have the right to forget them.
Karima Benoun, thank you for bringing us all those stories, and good luck for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.